720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for joining us today and sharing part of your Saturday here with us. Lots to do on the program today. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about data privacy and data brokers. There's a really nuanced conversation to be had there. We'll be joined by Douglas McMillan from the Washington Post to talk about that topic and the recent piece that he wrote for that publication. We're joined now by Ben Castleman, economics and business reporter at New York Times, who wrote about how investors are really changing the housing market by buying up a large amount of affordable housing and making it much more difficult for people to compete in that space who are actually looking for a place to live. Ben, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So talk us through this story. This is one of those, gosh, this was bound to happen kind of things, and yet here we are.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way to think about this is to take a little bit of a step back and think about what happened in the aftermath of the housing crisis and the Great Recession, which is that we had a ton of investors who kind of swooped in and bought up houses cheap, you know, out of foreclosure and that kind of thing. And the conventional wisdom at the time was they're going to come in, they're going to buy this up, they're going to hold on for a couple of years, then prices are going to rise, they're going to sell, and that'll be over. And instead, what we saw was investors bought up, and then they kept buying. And we're actually at a point now where investors are playing the biggest role in the housing market that they ever have. And it's especially happening at that kind of entry level, the spot where you would think about buying in for your first home. Now you're probably going to be competing with an investor.
Which is usually not ideal, because that's often someone who can pay cash and pay often a little bit more than the first-time home buyer.
Yeah, they can pay cash. It doesn't need to pass inspection. You don't have to go through the whole process of hoping the financing comes through. So if you're a seller and you've got a cash offer on the table, maybe it's a little bit more, maybe it's the same amount, but you know it's going to close quickly. You don't have all those contingencies. So yeah, you're probably going to take that cash offer, and it makes it really tough to compete if you're trying to buy in.
So what has fueled this continuing even once these Great Recession bargains, once that has started to shift out, what has kept investor buyers still so hot in the game?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a few factors that are going on here. One of them is sort of the benign factor, which there are a lot of people who are, for a set of reasons, choosing to rent, or they're having trouble getting their own financing, so they're forced into renting. And so a lot of investors are buying up homes and renting them out, and so there are people living in them. They're just living in them as renters instead of owners. You've then got a big Wall Street component here, which is, you know, we all know it's rates have been low. It's been tough to get returns. And so this has been a way of investors sort of flooding money into the housing market, often indirectly, that this is a lot of sort of small-time investors, flippers who might know their local market well. But they're getting money from Wall Street, from funds that are providing that financing at a much greater level than we've ever seen before.
There was one person in particular in the piece that you wrote, and for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet this out after the program so you can read it yourself. And there's a lot of people that you talk to in this, but there's one in particular. This poor woman has been trying to buy a house for such a long time, and this has played out in such an emotional and just kind of gut-wrenching way. She's lost, it seems like, opportunity after opportunity, to the point where she's given up on owning a house almost.
Yeah, this is a woman, Fatu, that I spoke to down in Atlanta. And, you know, she's the kind of person you would expect to be able to buy a house. She's an accounting professional. She had a budget of initially sort of around $300,000, which is in the Atlanta area, is a pretty reasonable amount for a home. And, you know, there are, if you go and look at the listings, you will see plenty of places in the neighborhoods where she's looking that are priced at her level. So on paper, it looks like she should be able to buy. And yet time and time and time again, she is losing out those homes to investors coming in with a cash offer. And, you know, she says, hey, I want to be a part of this neighborhood. She's was a black woman trying to buy into historically black neighborhoods, saying, you know, I want to be the next generation of sort of staples in this neighborhood who keep this place going. But it's really difficult for her to get a start.
And you've noted a couple of places in this story where race and gentrification are playing a big role in this. Like we talk about this in terms of investors and Wall Street, but then there's that piece of it too that I think we cannot not discuss, because that's so key too.
Yeah, I mean, think, look, this is a very complex issue. You know, we're talking here about investors, but investors are clearly, to some extent, reflecting trends that are happening in the housing market, right? So we have, in lots of places in this country, certainly in Atlanta where I was, certainly in Chicago, you have a lack of affordable housing, not necessarily meaning that in the kind of capital A affordable sense, but in the kind of just homes that normal people with normal jobs can afford. And we're seeing, you know, a lot more people choosing to move into, you know, urban neighborhoods. We're seeing a lot of people who want to be close to transit, close to the cities, but that then drives up prices. It makes it more difficult. And we've got this at a moment when there has not been a lot of building, construction of housing, particularly at that level of the market. You know, we see some luxury construction in a lot of places, but not a lot of construction at that kind of entry level. And so then you layer on top of that the competition from investors, and it can make it really tough.
And so given your expertise, this is your beat, this is a topic that you write about and think about all the time. Where does this, this economic cycle for housing has gone on a little bit longer, and it kind of continues. I think a lot of people, certainly here locally in Chicago, a lot of people are going, where does this end? What's about to shift? In your mind, at least on the kind of generally speaking on the national level, what are those tells to look for where this will begin to shift? Where and what are those going to be?
You know, it's interesting. I think that in the sort of second half of last year, mortgage rates started to rise, and a lot of us sort of thought we were seeing a turning over in that housing cycle. And then, of course, we've seen mortgage rates come back down and money flowing back in again. Obviously, if you're looking to refinance right now, that's a pretty good piece of news, but it sort of does extend that cycle. I think we have to keep in mind these are very different issues in different parts of the country, right? If you look at San Francisco or Seattle or New York, then you're seeing this sort of incredible demand that's not being met by the supply, driving up prices and really just sort of grinding the market to a halt on a certain level because there's not the inventory to buy. You look in a lot of other parts of the country, right? That's not the problem at all. You know, the issue there is that you have people, who don't earn the wages that they can afford to buy or frankly, who are leaving because there aren't opportunities. So to think about this as kind of one holistic national market, we went through sort of a cycle where that was true in the mid-2000s. But that was an unusual situation. I don't think we're going to see something like that repeat.
That's a very good point to look at it so in such specific regional areas, because I know with a lot of interest, a lot of people have been, certainly here, have been looking at the West Coast because of, Seattle to San Diego, those four main cities there along that coast. We have just seen that housing market just stop at where they were just pushing forward so hard and so hard. Suddenly no one could afford to live there. And it, as you said, ground to a halt, which in when we look at major metro areas, Chicago has been so low on that list for so long because our housing market has been just had so many very specific issues facing it. And suddenly we're grouped in those ways with the West Coast. So it is fascinating to kind of watch it by region and look at those regional considerations. And so in reporting on this story, I know you focused a lot on Atlanta in it, but in reporting on this story, what did you feel was most surprising or maybe was kind of lost in the narrative when people think about this issue? What are people not saying enough?
Well, I think what was interesting to me was that the places that we were seeing this investor activity, it actually mostly wasn't the San Franciscos and Seattles, perhaps because the prices there are just so high that you can't break in. The place that actually we saw the most activity was Philadelphia and Detroit. Those were cities where close to half of all entry-level homes were being bought by investors. We saw it a lot in Atlanta, Chicago a little bit less, but still a little bit more than the national average. And I think what we're seeing there is that these are places where there are still homes that are available at the 200,000, 250, you know, maybe a little bit up from that level. And that's sort of a sweet spot for investors to come in. They can buy up. You know, a lot of these are smaller time investors getting some money from Wall Street and being able to buy up a few places. But what that ends up meaning is that these places that seem like they should be the sort of bastions of affordability, right? That sweet spot of having both job opportunities and affordability. that those are the places where you're going to end up competing with investors, and it kind of makes it tricky. If you're in San Francisco and saying, man, I just can't afford to do this, maybe I'll go to Chicago, there are still opportunities there, and I can still afford it, well, now you may be competing with an investor for that opportunity.
It's so interesting, all the many nuanced factors that go into the housing market, and then to layer in the different regional considerations is just so, so interesting. I really appreciate you being with us today to talk through. And again, those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet this story out after the program. Thank you so much, Ben Castleman, economics and business reporter at The New York Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here in just a little bit, we're going to get you to news with Ryan Bro to check in on the latest. So, speaking of the New York Times, which we were just doing before the break, there is a story in the New York Times this week about drinking water from a can, and you would not think this would be as contentious of a topic as it is, but there is like people in this story who are downright like, no, I need to see the contents of the water. And yet, like sparkling water out of a can, not a big deal to people. People are sucking down that kind of sparkly flavor water like it's going out of style.
Yeah,
but the idea
we consume things that we can't see all the time.
All the time, but something about still water, people need to see it.
I never thought twice about it. And then, yeah, actually, when someone raises that concern, I'm like, wait, maybe
actually,
I should be able to see.
Maybe I should be able to see my
water. I never investigate.
I mean, I carry a refillable water bottle with me that I can't see in it. It's aluminum. And I'm sitting here looking at it like, well, gosh.
Well, you did. I hope you presumably
filled
it.
I did fill it myself, but still I'm like, well, that's kind of freaky. Like, what if I lift the lid off for a second and a bug crawled in? What do I do?
You never know.
Never know. But there's an interesting detail in this story, because this is really about how beverage companies are trying to nudge consumers toward more responsible behavior. Mm. Across the world, only 9% of the plastic ever made has been recycled. By contrast, 67% of the aluminum bought by consumers every year is reused. So, yeah, 9% versus 67%.
That's so strange.
Yeah, there's a lot of contempt for single-use plastic right now, and rightfully so. It ends up in landfills and you know, trashing our oceans quite quickly. So, and doing lots of damage. So, there's a lot of effort to move to non-plastic things, and water bottles is one of those things where, I mean, I've forgotten my water bottle before, my refillable one, and bought a water because I'm about that hydration, you know? And I feel bad. I feel like I hide it in my bag. I don't want people to see me using it. I feel terrible.
Oh, that's hilarious.
It's like buying a bottle of water, but they're clear. So I wonder.
I think that this, yeah, maybe it's because you can't see inside. That doesn't really ring true to me, though, for the reasons you cited, which are that you drink stuff all the time that you can't see. But that's in a bottle that's not clear.
So this reporter went around and was asking people who were buying beverages in the corner store in New York. People almost unanimously like, I need to see the contents of the water, he said. I need to see there's nothing inside.
I don't actually think that's it, though. I just refuse to believe that. What I think it is something we talked about last week or 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, probably. Which is just when food, if you just recontextualize food,
people freak out.
Even if it's the most minor thing, you just are like, wait, no, that's not what I know.
Yeah.
We talked about it with them trying to call salad dressing
salad frosting
for kids.
I'm still mad about that.
But in this case, and it's actually so funny.
That's a good point, Griffin.
There's a TV show called Difficult People that was on Hulu. Does that ring a bell?
I feel attacked right now.
What?
No, I'm just kidding.
No, it's just like you. No. The first episode, there's a point to this, I promise. In the first episode, they are trying to pitch a water company their idea for a water brand, which is a whole other thing. But they're pitching it to a guy who sells water in boxes. Like
the little
like,
white boxes with the
like,
black writing?
Like milk.
Yeah, I've seen those.
Like milk boxes, but with water. And they just are insistent that that it must taste like milk because it's in a box.
Wow.
And he says, no, it's just
water.
It's there's no milk in it. And I think it would taste a little milky.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the same thing. It's like, I don't know it that way.
Yeah. So I've talked a little tiny bit on the air before about some volunteer work I do around disaster stuff. And so Budweiser has canned still water for years.
Right.
In times of disaster, they will immediately start bottling or canning water and sitting out. But it's still kind of, it doesn't look like a beer can, but it is has some Budweiser branding on it that just says water really clearly. And often volunteers call it Floodweiser. But so many people, you know, even in dire situations, you hand someone a six pack of that or a case of that, they're like,
now's not the time.
Yeah, I don't want a beer. I want to, and it says water.
Right. Read the room.
It's so funny, but
well, brands are powerful, man.
You're exactly right, though. There is like the psychological component of like, I understand beer looks this way and water looks this way and salad dressing looks this way and frosting looks this way. How dare you mess with me? That's exactly right. All right, we need to take a break, get your news, all the good stuff. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us. We're joined now by Douglas McMillan, corporate accountability reporter at Washington Post. He joins us by phone, and he wrote about the importance of data brokers to modern business and how these new laws in California and Vermont are aiming to change how we work with those data brokerage firms. Douglas, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. So talk us through this story, if you would. I think we've had, certainly on this show, a lot of conversations about data privacy, but we're usually talking about that in context with tech giants and records and things like that. This is a little bit different and very nuanced story about data collection. So start at the beginning, if you would, and tell us what we need to know.
Sure. A lot of the headlines we're seeing about data privacy these days, as you mentioned, are about Facebook and Google and these companies that most consumers know about. But what is going on out there as well is this whole industry of data middlemen, or these data brokers that often consumers have no direct connection to, and often consumers don't even know their names. These are companies with names like Axiom, Experian, Epsilon. A lot of the data that they gather is public record. They get data from property records, DMVs. They also find other ways to get into private databases, such as your shopping receipts. If you have a grocery loyalty card, sometimes they can get your transaction history. They try to get your magazine subscriptions, because that can be an indicator of the things you interest. So these companies are piecing together all these data points about you, and they're putting together a profile. Interestingly, you know, we dug into this world and how these companies work, and found out that there's dozens of these companies out there, and a lot of their activity is buying and selling data to and from each other. So not only do most people not know that their data is being collected by these companies, but you don't even know where your data is being passed to and who they are buying and selling it from.
And so Vermont and California are making movement in this area. I would love to hear about that. But then also nationally, if there's any more on the federal level movement being done to give people a little more control over their data.
Yeah, there's some discussion about what can we do at a federal level to at least give users more transparency into how this works. And one of the proposals people have talked about for a few years, can we make a national database or registry where we force these companies to sign up, give some kind of transparency into their business practices, and that would help users at least know who has their data and what's being done with it. So there's a kind of an early test of this idea is being done in Vermont right now. Vermont is the first state to actually pass a law that created a database like this. In this case, it's only for data brokers who have information about Vermont residents, which turns out to be dozens of companies meet that bill. But unfortunately, you know, we found that this effort has actually showed how difficult it is to create such a database. We spent a lot of time looking at these documents that they offered Vermont, which are written in really confusing legal language. It looks like most of them are written by lawyers. We found several firms that actually do buy and sell data about Vermont residents just failed to sign up altogether. So the kind of the first high-profile test of how do you rein in these data brokers and how do you make their practices more transparent, seems to be showing, you know, how difficult that process is.
And what are the consequences for the data brokers in Vermont who don't, or who have data around Vermont residents who don't comply with this and who don't register?
Well, the state says that it can fine a company up to $10,000 in a year. However, it's still a very new effort. And even though we went out and as a test, we went out and the Washington Post bought data from a company on Vermont residents, that company is called AmeriList, was not registered with Vermont, was one of these companies that, you know, decided not to be part of Vermont's database and ended up, after we pointed it out to them, ended up signing up to the database 4 months late. I asked Vermont whether there's going to be any punishment or penalty for that company, and they said, you know, it's too early to tell. You know, we'll take a look at it, but we're judging these on a case-by-case basis. So there's a criticism that, you know, there's not any teeth to this law, and there's not any serious consequences to companies breaking these laws. So I think that as we talk more about potentially a national law, you have to think about how, you know, what is the enforcement mechanism? Is a fine of $10,000 going to actually be a significant deterral, a significant way to stop companies from doing this when many of them are making millions of dollars in revenue?
Right. I think this conversation is such an interesting one. I feel like Europe is a couple of years ahead of us around data privacy conversations. There's the right to be forgotten law there and things like that. And I know in Ireland and the UK, there was a court that really kind of threw the book at Facebook. There's a lot of conversations, I think, that are further along and further developed in Europe than they are here around this topic. So, when we look at this, I think some people kind of forget the reason why this is important. I think there's just I don't want strangers having access to my identity. But sometimes, as you point out in the story, there are some real consequences to this, and there are some populations much more vulnerable than others for safety concerns or people who are perhaps mentally ill who could have their identity stolen and not realize it.
Yeah, there's some very, I would say, disturbing lists out there that if you are, you know, somebody who wants to take advantage of people, if you're a bad guy, you can potentially use these databases and data lists that are pretty freely available on this, in this data broker market. A couple of the ones that we found were, you can find a list of people who have Alzheimer's disease. And you can, I mean, that's ostensibly it's meant for drug companies or healthcare providers who want to offer services to people with Alzheimer's, but you can, you know, think about how that could pretty easily be used in the wrong hands. You can find lists of people who are Muslim. You can find people who have different religions, and obviously, in today's environment, that those kinds of lists, again, in the wrong hands, could be pretty bad consequences. So I think that there are some pretty disturbing uses of this information, and all the more reason to think about, you know, how do we actually rein in these practices?
Yeah, certainly. And as you note in the story, and for those who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and share this story after the program so you can read it for yourself. It's really, really interesting. There's a lot of really, really fascinating reporting in here. But as you note in the story, that Vermont's registry, as they're trying to get this assembled and off the ground, it kind of shows us really what this data broker economy is made of and what it's all about. As you have been following this and reporting on it, what has been most surprising to you about seeing kind of how the sausage is made in this economy?
Most surprising to me is how many of these companies are working together in kind of a, you know, we call it in the story a data assembly line. And the example that we focused on was students who are usually high school students can sign up to these quizzes or these surveys on a site owned by this company, Advisors. They sign up to a survey they offer them a chance to win a $10,000 scholarship, and they submit these surveys of their information. That information is then sold off to another company called ALC. This company, ALC, then overlays that person's name with other information from another data broker, like their demographics, where they live, what their likely income level is. They also overlay it with information about their likely race and their ethnicity, and they repackage this and sell it all to marketers. So what I started off on this reporting thinking was like, a data broker collects your information from one place and then they sell it to a marketer. But really there are all these in-between steps that you kind of get this packaging and repackaging and resold effect that in the end it makes the whole process more opaque and more difficult for the average person to follow and find out where their data has been.
It's so very, very interesting. And I really, again, I'm going to share this story after the program because, when we think about data brokers, I had the same thought that it's point A to point B, but there all the stops along the way and all the money changing hands really, really is very eye-opening that you talk about in the story. So I appreciate you being with us today. Thank you so much, Douglas McMillan, Corporate Accountability Reporter at Washington Post.
Thanks, Amy.
Thanks so much. All right, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, more of this here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. So we were just talking with Douglas McMillan, Corporate Accountability Reporter at Washington Post. I thought that story that he wrote was so interesting, and I really am going to continue to follow what's happening in Vermont and California about data brokerage firms, because as he said, when he began the project, he thought, well, you collect data and then you sell it to a marketer, but there are so many stops along the way, and it really gets very interesting. There is a local piece to this, too, that the New York Times wrote about just a couple of days ago, and that's so the University of Chicago Medical Center announced a partnership to share patient data with Google in 2017, and that it was positioned as a way to unlock information that's in electronic health records and make it easier to share between medical professionals and in the longer term improve predictive analysis around medicine and help diagnose things faster and help doctors just be better.
Right. Google is developing technology that can help analyze records and stuff, or first needs to analyze records in order to develop the technology.
Right. But and they need data in order to be able to build that technology on top of
it. Exactly. And I don't know exactly. I think there's a lot of things they want to do in the health space, but it just as part of their initiative to develop this health technology in whatever form it takes, a lot of it is AI based and then other kinds of stuff, too. They need to analyze a lot of medical records, old and then sometimes from the recent past.
And I've often said technology is not inherently bad. Where we get into trouble is when we're so gung-ho, we run out of the gate with it before we've thought about the consequences. And sometimes we can't even imagine them. Sometimes there are unintended consequences. But so often we get into this space where the law has not caught up with behavior. And it usually takes something terrible happening to set precedent and to get the law to catch up with it. But so nonetheless, what has happened is this past week on Wednesday, University of Chicago Medical Center and Google were sued in a potential class action lawsuit accusing the hospital of sharing hundreds of thousands of patient records with Google without taking out and stripping it of identifiable date stamps or doctor's notes.
Right. That's an important detail because when you see the headline, it took a little reading for me to understand because they're being sued over sharing these medical records, but that's what they were in partnership to do.
Exactly.
The thing is that it needs to be stripped of identifiable information. So what you have is just raw sort of info that can't be traced back to the patients. And that includes names, social security numbers, and dates also of like dates and times of medical procedures or whatever. They've done partnerships like this, I understand, with other schools before, and I don't think either of those has led to a lawsuit yet. Google has similar partnerships with Stanford and University of California, San Francisco, it says.
And I want to say, I need to fact check this, but I want to say also, because Boston is kind of becoming the genetics hub in the tech space, I think there's a partnership with MIT as well, I think.
Yeah, I would believe it. And they had a similar situation like this in London, a lab that existed there that was owned by Alphabet, the company that owns Google, called DeepMind, that was doing similar sharing of data and stuff like this. And that was met with similar accusations to this this program that's happening now.
I think it's such an interesting topic, and unfortunately, the thing that's going to have to happen to set precedent is going to, I'm sure it's not, you know, it's going to be something kind of terrifying and something that really, you know, is really personal. It like has a great personal cost to somebody. Probably, I'm guessing it will be in the medical space, perhaps genetic. There's so many people that are so freely giving their DNA because it's fun. You want to hear where did great grandma come from? Where was the old country? I think people are specifically in the genetics world, but
right.
And some of that is, you know, it's interesting. The idea that people are voluntarily saying, yeah, opt me in if I can help save a life with my DNA and my habits, and I'll answer questions, and sure, let's do it. And that's fine. I think the key issue, and this is kind of, I think, where we got to with our last guest too, that was talking with us about this topic. And that is, it's the lack of transparency. I think there's some things, if it was transparent, that was like, okay, we're going to collect your data, and we will share it with the following companies, and you'll be able to track where it's shared and who's bought it. I think some people would go, yeah, okay, that's fine.
And honestly, I think a lot of people feel that way anyway.
Yeah.
Knowing what can be done with data, they still kind of feel like, what do I don't notice. And it's easy to slip into that because you don't feel it when your data is being trafficked, you know?
Well, and trafficked, I think, is a better word. We tend to say broker, but I think trafficked is a more appropriate word.
Right. It happens without you knowing,
yeah.
But that's worrisome too. And as a broader, on a personal level, it's one thing, but as a broad, as the way that, you know, business is done and structured, it's a little freaky.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I think part of that is because we're pretty locked into, and I think a lot of people feel very confident about the narrative that like, oh, that means my ads are more personalized for me. But it's in fact much deeper than that. There's so much more to it. There's a book, I've referenced this on the show before because I love this book. It was so eye-opening for me. It's called Terms of Service by Jacob Silverman. It's so good. I've interviewed him before. He is such a smart guy, and he put a lot of effort into this book. Even though it's a few years old and so much has happened since he wrote it, it is still very, very, it's a must read. It's so interesting.
Yeah.
I think even if you're not really comfortable in this space of data and technology, it's an accessible read that will bring you into it pretty quickly and make a lot of sense of it.
Yeah. And I think in this particular case, what the sticking point is the dates, because it's my understanding, I might be a little off on this, but it's my understanding that these records were stripped of names and social security numbers, stuff like that. They weren't completely untouched, but some of the dates were left in there too. And that's kind of where the lawsuit comes in, saying Google didn't have this other information, but it has the dates, and Google can use dates in order to find people, or using those dates in addition to all the other information that Google has about everybody, which is a lot. It knows, you know, every site you visited, and basically it knows where you are, and, you know, in conjunction with what it already knows, because it's such a wide reaching company. I mean, I can't think of one that knows more about people. All it needs is a date or something. So I think that's where this battle will kind of be fought. Now, it's worth saying that Google says they follow guidelines under HIPAA.
Yeah, and the University of Chicago Medical Center, in a statement, said the claims in this lawsuit are without merit.
Right.
We complied with the laws and regulations with patient privacy. You know,
it'll be
interesting to watch, and I think it has the potential to update HIPAA laws for data privacy, because that's all about it being the word that always kind of things hinge on with HIPAA violation is de-identifiable. And so has enough been stripped out that it becomes de-identifiable? I don't know. Here's one of those things that'll set precedent and kind of tweak HIPAA laws a little bit to apply to data sharing and the electronic space. We shall see. Well, More of this next week. We have to stop for now. Turn things over to Scott Catoon for the Startup Showcase, all that good stuff. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.